Hey, WTFers. Today's sponsor is AdamandEve.com. Get 50% off any item along with free gifts and shipping when you enter WTF at the checkout. That's AdamandEve.com. AdamandEve.com. Have fun.
Lock the gates!
Are we doing this? Really?
Wait for it.
Are we doing this?
Wait for it.
Pow!
What the fuck?
WTF.
And it's also, what the fuck?
What's wrong with me?
It's time for WTF.
What the fuck?
With Mark Maron.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck nicks? How are ya? It's me, Mark Maron. I am in London, England. I've not done any podcasting from London, England until today, the day before I leave London, England. And I've got to be honest with you, I've had a pretty great time here. Well, I knew I would, but, you know, I've been a little awkward, a little adverse to traveling to the UK, to traveling to Ireland. I make myself a little crazy, but that's not really the issue. The issue is that I spent 2 weeks here and I didn't do a lot. I did a few things because I felt like I had to do them. I did shows every night at 10 at night. The run went really well. The audiences were much better than I thought. There were a lot of what the fuckers that came out, and I certainly appreciate you being here. I had a lot of good food. I was staying in Soho. It was terrific. I took a walk down by the river. I saw Parliament. I saw Buckingham Palace. I saw, you know, Big Ben. I did the Monument. I went to the East End, and I walked down around there. I saw the Tower of London. I did a lot of stuff. I crammed it in. I didn't get to a couple places. I didn't get to the British Museum. I literally went, stood in front of the British Museum, knowing what was in the British Museum, having been there once when I was just out of high school. And I don't know if I was depressed. I don't know what happened, but I got out of bed. I've been sleeping really late here. I don't know why. I got out of bed. I'm like, I got to go to the British Museum. Fuck it. You know, I need to see, you know, the Rosetta Stone. I need to see that crystal skull. I need to see some mummies. I need to see all the stuff that the British Empire has stolen from other people over the years and stocked up into that British Museum. And I just stood there in front of that place. It was so big and so daunting. And I got exhausted and resentful. And I couldn't fucking deal. And I thought to myself, like, do I have to see the Rosetta Stone? I mean, it was essential in figuring out how to interpret hieroglyphics. Just the fact that I remembered that means that the British Museum had done what it needed to do. It unearthed a memory of something I learned in a history class, probably in ninth grade, and I felt satisfied. And I went and got a shave by a Cypriot instead. I got a shave down the street from the British Museum, and the guy smacked me in the face afterwards. It was like hostile. Like he was jamming the brush into my face. It was not a good thing. And I didn't know why. He did a very good job, but I didn't know what I was supposed to do. Who hits a guy after a shave? And I didn't know if I should tip him more for that. But it was like a couple of smacks on my face. I got past it. The only weird thing that really happened here, to be honest with you, was I'd done a pretty good show. I've been putting my heart out there and doing some pretty good work, about an hour, 15 minutes a night, just me. And I'd done a pretty good show, and I was leaving backstage, and I was walking down the stairs, and the audience was still, you know, letting itself out. I mean, they were all walking down the stairs. And, you know, there's that moment where you're performing, you walk out, you lock eyes with someone who was in the audience. I see this woman looking at me. I'm looking at her. She's with a guy. She was actually with a friend of mine, Jerry Sadowitz. And she locks eyes with me. And there's that moment where you're anticipating something. You know, you're always sort of fishing for a compliment in your heart. You'd like some kudos. You'd like something nice to be said about what they just saw if they're going to lock eyes with you. And I don't know if this was British or what, but she just said, you all right? Are you all right? Are you all right? Are you all right? That's about the worst thing you can say to me after a show. Am I all right? Yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine. Why didn't you just not say anything? How would that have been? Why not just give me a dirty look? Was that being polite or didn't matter? They also say, like grown-ups say, they got to take a wee, like publicly when they have to pee. They literally say, I'm gonna have a wee. Oh, it's so cute. It's like they're seven. Here they are in just the you know what's left of centuries of empire. Just people saying, I've got to take a wee. I'm gonna have a wee. Really cute. I was in the same space as a small opera production of La Boheme. an updated, very small version of that opera. So the set I was working with was, it looked to be an apartment. It was a sort of an updated, modern version of La Boheme, and it literally looked like the apartment of a few of the girlfriends I had in college. There were paintings strewn about, a guitar, a shitty couch. It looked like it folded out to a bed. There were pictures on the wall. It looked like a shitty artist's apartment. And throughout the run, I improvised in that space about having dated women who lived in those kind of places. And then I sort of condescended to painting, to saying, like, we all had this friend or this girlfriend, the painter. Who the fuck dedicates their life to painting? What a ridiculous dream that is. And I had some spite in my voice, and I'm actually feeling guilty about it today. And I'll tell you why, because I went to the Tate Modern Museum, which is spectacular. It is one of the best museums I've ever been in my life. And I think I needed to go. And I was actually not going to go to the Tate Museum because I'm like, how much modern art can I see in one lifetime? I've got this angry detachment from art because I had an experience where I'm like, I don't know how to integrate this shit anymore. I don't know if I'm going to learn where it belongs in the history of art or in the context of how it was created. A lot of that stuff is starting to dissolve in my brain. It's starting to dissipate. I no longer have a context anymore because I'm getting older and I don't give a shit as much. So I started to detach, and then I realized I started to sound stupid and angry about what? Painting? Painting is supposed to be great. It's supposed to take you to another place. It's supposed to, you know, bring everything and together in that moment on that canvas for you to take in and for it to sort of, you know, drop into the empty slots in your brain and blossom something. Art is supposed to punch you in the brain, and it's supposed to stay punched. That's what a good piece of art does. It doesn't matter whether you understand it or not, you need to be punched in the brain. So I went in there, and it was breathtaking. And I don't have that experience very often. This museum is breathtaking. It used to be some sort of power plant, and the bottom floor is where they kept the turbines. So it's this amazingly huge space. And just the structure itself blew me away. And here I was walking through exhibits of artists that I've seen before, but having a completely different experience because of the way they were presented at this museum. Like whole rooms of Gerhard Richter. I mean, Gerhard Richter is probably one of the greatest artists of the 20th century, and you're just standing in a room with these massive, almost 10-foot tall abstracts, like six of them, punching in the brain from all angles. A whole room of Cy Twombly, just beautiful big red-pink brushstrokes just smacking your face around, just smacking your brain around. Wake up, man. Look at this. This is fucking poetry. This only happens here on this canvas. This will never happen again anywhere else. You are standing in front of the final piece, and it is done, and it is here. Reckon with it, fuckface. That's what that was saying to me. And I'm like a guy that wanted to be an artist. You know, I wrote poems. I did photography. I took a lot of pictures. I thought about it. I didn't do it. There's no reason for me to resent it. It's such an enriching thing. And even if I don't understand where anything goes or what anything does, I was in an Andy Warhol room. And even Warhol, as tired as that guy may get, I love some of his shit. And they displayed it beautifully. Then I started thinking, like, what the fuck did I do? What did I do? What did I do with my life? Oh, by the way, I also had a pork belly and applesauce sandwich at Borough Market that was spectacular. Do I use that word too much? It was awesome. I haven't been eating that much meat, been trying to be good, but that today was the day. Today was the day for paintings and pork belly. Today was the day. But what did I do with my life? Am I an artist? I mean, I have a hard time calling myself that. I don't know if comics are artists. I know that sometimes everything is happening in a very immediate sense, that what's going on stage will never happen again, that experience between me and the audience will never happen again. It's not on tape either. It is in a moment. It will never happen again. A woman stood up in a show at the Soho Theater here after I did three Jesus jokes and said, "That's it. I've had enough. I'm a Jehovah's Witness. I'm leaving." Why the advertisement? Why do we have to billboard the faith? Do you think someone else is going to get up and go, "Oh, if she's going, I'm going too, because I'd like to be a Jehovah's Witness"? But there are moments that happen on stage. I don't know if what I do is art, because I don't know how consistent I really am with it. Is a well-crafted joke art? Is comedy really art? It doesn't seem to really hold up for the long haul. It doesn't seem to hold up historically. Maybe some plays do, but does stand-up hold up? Do people really go back and look at Pryor as something timeless? Do we do timeless? Is that what we do? I don't think we do timeless. I think we do timely. On this show, we're going to talk to a British comedian, Stuart Lee, who I had to be introduced to. This is the weird thing about British comedy and American comedy. This guy is a great comic. He's an inspired comic. He's a truly unique comic. And if anybody that I've seen lately can that I think might be, you know, someone I would call an artist, it would be this guy. And I'm not even sure why. He's been doing it as long as I have, if not longer. And the business here is so much different than the business is in America. And I had no idea who he was. So I had to do sort of a cram course on him and then have an interview with him. But he's a very unique comedian. There's very rarely that you see people who are truly unique. And Stuart Lee is truly unique. And I felt like an idiot because I don't know much about British comedy. I'm embarrassed about that. Maybe I need, but I don't know much about American comedy either. I don't know much about comedy that you know, beyond my garage, to be honest with you. Okay, what the fuckers? I know that some of you are a little uptight. I know some of you are pretty proper. I run in two worlds. But look, our sponsor is Adam and Eve, and that's just the way it goes. That adamandeve.com, if you go there, look, you can get 50% off any item along with free gifts, free shipping when you enter WTF at the checkout. All right, that's at adamandeve.com. And what they have at adamandeve.com is grown-up stuff. Dirty movies. Oh, no, let's not say dirty. Let's say adult. I like them. I got a few. Toys. Plenty of toys. And I want to reach out to the women if I can without insulting any of you. Is that I've said this before. I've never dated a woman that didn't have a toy. And you know what kind of toy I'm talking about. So if you need a new one, they got them. They got all kinds. Go to adamandeve.com. You can put WTF in the window at checkout. And you get free shipping, get 50% off any item, and you get some free gifts, some grown-up movies. So enjoy that. Don't be afraid to buy a new toy. They come in all colors and shapes. Some of them require batteries. Some of them don't. Some of them strap on. Some of them, I think they have one that actually straps onto your chin. That's silly. But, you know, maybe it'll look silly, but maybe it'll feel good. That is the obstacle we have to cross here. AdamandEve.com. In my temporary housing here in London, Stuart Lee, I don't want to say a living legend because I don't like being called that, but certainly a great, unique comedian is here. How are you, Stuart?
Fine. Thanks for having us.
I saw you in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
In 2007.
Oh, in 2007. Yeah, right.
Because people took me to see you. They said, you got to see this guy. I was a miserable wreck of a person when I was there. I had a miserable time, but I was so stuck in my own shit and, you know, and I'd never been to the festival. But but your pacing and your delivery had a profound effect. But then it just sort of, I didn't look you up again. Yeah,
fine.
I went to the United States. Well, no. This is the thing, though. And then people, you know, were telling me like this, you know, you got to see this guy. You guys have things in common.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I was nervous when you were coming up here because I spent a lot of time watching your stuff and you're a singular voice. You know, no one is like you.
Well, it's just I've copied people that you don't know about.
Is that what happened? Okay. Yeah, well, now that it's explained. But well, it seems to me that your stand-up, you know, and when I watch it, has a very, not only is it deliberate, but like there's a timing to the sound that you have a very specific pace that you're willing to wait.
Yeah, well, I do like that. But, you know, when I was a teenager, I was lucky or unfortunate, depending on, you know, which way you view it, in that of the first 10 stand-ups I saw, by just statistical probability, it turned out that 6 or 7 of them were those kind of slow-paced, deadpan
like
clubs.
Who?
Well, the first stand-up I ever saw, apart from when I was a little kid and would see things with my mum, like the Two Ronnies and stuff, like old vaudeville sort of stuff, was... In the immediate sort of post-punk era in Britain, we had this alternative comedy boom. I don't think you really had the same thing in the States. There was no need for it because there'd always been a wide variety of stand-up. You had a Lenny Bruce, but you also had mainstream guys as well.
But no one knew him. I didn't know him. And as much as he gets, you know, bandied about, you know, in terms of you really, as someone our age, I think I'm a little older than you, you've got to put him into context.
Well, to me,
it's meaningless.
To me, it looks like there was a tradition of stand-up in the States. Right. What really wasn't that here. There was guys in like working men's clubs all doing the same gags.
Right. Like vaudeville almost.
And then you had like odd little things like raconteurs or sort of folk singers like Billy Connolly who did bits between the songs, and eventually the bits between the songs became...
Oh, so you had no real stand-up.
Didn't really have it in the same way. You had occasional blips like Dave Allen from Ireland, who's very like... you know, an American stand-up in lots of ways. But so in about 79, 80, it sort of started here, stand-up in a way that you'd recognise. And outside of London, where there was about three clubs, the places you used to see these people was opening for bands. And I saw this guy, Peter Richardson, who went into the comic strip opening for Dex's Midnight Runners in 1982 in Birmingham, doing a character of a Mexican bandit who just spoke really in a really slow, threatening way. Then I saw Phil Jupitus, who's very different. I saw him opening for Billy Bragg. He's a much livelier bouncer.
I've met him,
But the one that really got me was a guy called Ted Chippington, who opening for The Fall, who were the best band in Britain and are still going. And Ted Chippington, I don't know where he'd really come from. He wore like a tight sort of Teddy Boy 50s rock and roll suit. He had shaved all his hair off. He looked very menacing. And he basically told the same joke over and over again for about half an hour with a noun changed each time whilst drinking from a bottle in a really slow way. And he didn't seem to care whether the audience liked it or not. And I've subsequently found out he preferred going down badly to well. But I thought that was absolutely just, it was fantastic. That was my sort of moment where people older than me who are in bands went, oh, I saw the Sex Pistols and there was only 12 people there. And I realized you didn't have to be able to play. You didn't have to be able to write a song. When I saw Ted Chippen, I thought, it doesn't have to be funny. You don't have to talk about anything. You don't have to look as if you're enjoying it. You don't even have to go quickly. And then when I was a student in 87, 3 years later in Edinburgh, I went out with a student show and I saw a bill that was Norman Lovett. He's about 60 now, very slow, deadpan. Arnold Brown, who's about 75 now. He was a bit like, he's an old Scottish guy who, again, was very slow and dry and deadpan. I can't remember any of his punchlines, but I remember the sort of setup. So things like, I walked into a branch of Our Price, the record store, as I have every right so to do. Things like that. They'll be full of these unnecessary bits of detail. So it's them two, and then Arthur Smith and Jerry Sadovitz are on the same bill. They aren't the same, but it was a lot of the early people I saw was slow and weird, and I sort of thought I could do that. But if I'd seen all the upbeat, fast, happy guys talking about sports and girls, I probably wouldn't be here now. Yeah, I was just lucky that I saw all the odd, monotonous people, and I was quite an odd, monotonous child. I think it sort of looked to me like something I could do.
Well, it's interesting to me that you, the reason you saw them and the reason they existed was because the comedy business did not exist here, and that these guys had to be pioneers or freaks to just oddballs. I don't mean to say freaks in a negative way, to take the position. And it seems to me that because Britain is the way it is, that there's an intimacy to the business and to the power of somebody making an impact. Like, you know, you live in a country where reviews make a difference, you know, for stand-up shows. That's unbelievable to me.
Although again, that's sort of only it's in about the last 10 years, right? In 20 years ago when I started in the Edinburgh Fringe, when there's loads of comics on all August in Scotland, you know, the cookery critic would be someone would go, oh, can you go and review some comedy? You know, it would be like really, but then about 10 years ago, they started to realize that not all comics were the same and that we do different things. And now there is a sort of school of criticism for comedy, but it's a symbiotic thing because here, something that's happened here that I'm not sure if it's happened in the States in the same way is there's loads of comics doing loads of clubs, doing 20 minute sets.
Right.
Then there's also this kind of viable mid-range circuit where every year, you go back to the arts centre in the little provincial town with a new hour and 20 minutes and maybe with an opening act, and the show's got a different title to last year's, and you're kind of expected to turn it over. You know, you kind of build up a body of work. And there's probably 100 odd people doing that, you know. So there's this, then there's the really famous people that now can do Wembley Stadium, you know.
Right.
But I don't know if there's quite the same. There's this weird little mini circuit.
Well, that's starting to happen, actually, in the States behind you.
Yeah.
Because what we had was a comedy club boom, which you know, created a lot of monsters. Created a lot of mediocrity. Created a lot of hacks who were able to work. And now what's happening is because of the internet and because of exposure that people have a little more control over, they can build their own audiences.
Well, I mean, the internet in that way changed my life. And I feel like some old guy going, oh, there's this thing, the internet.
Yeah.
And you can go on it and there's it's mainly pornography, but there's other stuff.
Occasionally there's funny things.
But I mean, it is, you know, I gave up for 4 years. And one of the reasons, when I started again, I realized.
You quit for 4 years?
Yeah, I quit stand up, from 2000 to 2004, yeah.
What? How the hell do you do that?
Well, I just.
What do you do in that time?
Well, I didn't really do anything for a year. I wrote music reviews for
Why'd you quit?
Because I was getting really bad reviews all the time. I was with an agency that couldn't seem to sort of work out how to tour me or place me. I'd be keep going to clubs around the country where I'd go down really badly.
Why do you think you went down badly? Because, I mean, you're a guy who has control of the craft, and despite the fact that whether they know you or not, you didn't... Was
well,
it you or
them?
Well, I
think I'd been doing the same... I think it was a mixture of things of like... We had a comedy boom, right? You know, and that meant people started going to clubs for a night out, you know, and to have chicken in a basket and then a disco afterwards. And I'm not a night out, you know. I'm
yeah, I know that feeling.
Kind of at, you know,
I'm definitely not.
And I need people to come because they want to see the comedy rather than as a kind of as a kind of entree to...
I guess we'll go if we can dance later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
to know that you're not that guy is a tremendous self-realization.
Yeah, I realized I wasn't that guy, but I didn't know what to do about it. And then in the 4 years I had off, I realized that there was
a long time.
Yeah, I realized there was like MySpace, and there was also this other thing happened where between about 2000 2004, between me quitting and coming back, people had started setting up lots of little gigs around London that explicitly weren't a night out,
not mainstream, you know, comedy rooms,
and they'd give them intimidating names like Book Club or whatever.
Almost smart like, people's room.
Yeah, almost like designed to not, you know, like
to alienate idiots.
To alienate idiots. Yeah, yeah. And rather than being tolerated at these, I found that I was welcomed by the people that were booking them, who remembered me from doing like weird culty things when they were teenagers. Some of them, you know, and so suddenly the people that had liked me but weren't in a position of power could suddenly book me or write about me, and you know, it just sort of turned around. Also, in the 4 years I had off, two other things happened, which was, one, I ended up inadvertently becoming sort of well known for something else. I got asked by a composer that I'd worked with to co-write the words for an opera about Jerry Springer.
Yeah, right? I read about this. I wish I'd seen it.
And that
yeah.
became that got a lot of good reviews. And I think what that meant was then when I did stand up again, people had to kind of go, well, he must be doing this for a reason, as he's co-written a theatrical hit. So there must be, he must be doing this boring stand up like knowingly. He must be on purpose rather than a mistake. The other thing that happened was, Ricky Gervais became famous, and Ricky Gervais always cited me and Sean Locke, who's another British stand-up, as his favourite acts. And he was so famous by the time I started doing stand-up again that I said to him, can you give me a quote for a poster? And he did. Said Stuart Lee is the most cliche-free comedian in Britain or something. And suddenly I sold out an Edinburgh run in 5 minutes, and then a Soho Theatre run off the back of that. So it was honestly... I think it was largely down to his patronage, and also to having been involved in this opera, which meant that different kinds of people started coming to see me, theatre people or broadsheet newspaper readers, or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Off the back of that. So, and then the internet meant I could headhunt my own audience.
I could contact
them. It totally changed everything.
So most of your TV exposure, I mean, when you were younger, you did a lot of radio, and you were in a team for a while.
Yeah, I did a series for BBC Two called Fist of Fun in the mid-90s with a guy called Richard Herring.
I've met him. I met him in Scotland.
Well,
he's the
British equivalent of you. He's
right.
The podcast king.
The wizard.
And, you know, at the time, that got average reviews, pretty good audience figures, was not recommissioned, was never released on video. When we toured it, no one came. We used to lose money. And somehow in the interim, after it being decommissioned, we found probably not unlike David Cross's
Mr. Show.
Mr.
Yeah.
Show. Yeah, yeah. In fact, I saw a pilot of that after we'd done our... I was at the pilot recording of Mr. Show in LA in like 95 or something, after we'd done our first series. I thought, wow, this is really interesting. This is sort of the same. But it's here,
yeah.
And I think we enjoyed a similar thing where 10 years later, people are going, "Oh, I used to love that."
Yeah,
but at the time,
yeah,
you know, nothing. And also, a lot of the people that say I used to love it are now other comics or writers, or it seemed like it connected with all those people. But,
well, yeah, so you seem to be square one for what would be the equivalent of British new wave English comedy, new wave alternative comedy. For a lot of these kids, though.
Yeah,
like, you know,
I mean, it's really weird, like, to meet people that say it was, you know, significant to them then. Because it was like nearly 20 years ago, and at the time we didn't really have
no commercial success.
No, well, I think it's that people didn't really know how to tour comedy then. It was all new. I mean, we used to go out on tours and they go, oh, yeah, it's like rock and roll. Put them in a van, put them in hotels, spend loads of money on it. And we come back like 1,500 quid in debt, you know. So it was sort of no one quite knew
how to do it.
Yeah, it wasn't ready. You could do that now.
So Well, now, because you can get your following. And you seem to be, like, I go online, like, I feel like a stupid American in the sense that I don't have any, you know, real awareness of the British comedy scene.
Yeah.
I barely have an awareness of a lot of what's going on in America comedically. Yeah. But, I mean, you're entrenched here. I mean, you've been around a while, and you're very respected.
Well, in both worlds.
Yeah,
you know, the back end of it's happened really quickly. I mean, like, last night I did a gig in Bridport in a cinema, 450 people.
Yeah.
And people going, I can't believe you've come to Bridport. And it's exactly the sort of small town that I go and do 400 people in all the time. I don't know why there's this sort of perception now, I think, because of having done a telly series and had lots of good press that I'm, you know. But I mean, four years ago, I wasn't getting anyone. You know, it's again, it's sort of.
So you'd go there, no one would come.
Yeah, not that.
So you're actually just coming into what you've earned.
Yeah,
on some level.
But I also think it will go away again.
Well, of course,
I think I think there's a glass ceiling to being the alternative comedian. You know?
But there's a glass ceiling to anything.
Yeah,
I mean, what I'm like seeing after I look at your stuff, which I think is impressive because, you know, outside of it being funny and I don't laugh easily.
Yeah,
is that there's a commitment to something, you know, higher than just, you know, entertaining people. And I don't know whether that's conscious or not, but your style is your style.
Yeah.
And whether it's taken a long time for people to know it, there seems to be something that, like, the reason you quit is the reason why you're good.
Well, I couldn't carry on trying to get what I did to work in those
because
places.
It was just killing you, the heartbreak of it.
Yeah, you know, but now I think people would look. I remember a guy coming up to me after I died somewhere.
Yeah,
and I did all right. I made a living. There were enough places where it did work.
Yeah,
and just he couldn't believe that I was a comedian. He couldn't believe that I could possibly do it for a living. And I went, well, I've been doing it 12 years. And he's going, you must be like a teacher or something mucking around. I'm going, no, it's what. And he wasn't angry. He just was utterly baffled by it. And I think people thought that I just didn't know how to do it, whereas in fact I'd chosen to do something else. You know? My mum had never seen me write until this tour, the last tour I did. She came once.
Never?
No, she saw me 20 years ago.
Just last year?
Yeah, doing live stand-up. And she came to an early show in the tour, and she saw the bit where I throw the whole gig and run around for 20 minutes asking people why they don't find it funny and climb up into the balconies and look like I'm having a breakdown. And she saw the 10-minute bit where nothing seems to be working. And afterwards, she was talking to me. She was saying, it must be very difficult to do. And she didn't really say anything. And I thought, oh, you think that was a failure, right? And I couldn't, and I'd lost control of the room. Then she came to see it again on the tour, where I stage managed most of the same things.
Yeah.
And then thought it was really good, because she realized it was a performance.
Right, right, right.
Rather than a man who couldn't do comedy. Yeah. Doing it wrong. And I kind of think you get this, I mean, again, it's pretentious and self-aggrandizing for us, I think, to compare ourselves to jazz musicians. But
not many people do.
But, you know.
I mean, it's impressive that you know about jazz enough.
Well, but it's that kind of thing where people go, they can't play, it's rubbish. But then if they suddenly do play and show that they can, then those people have to then view what sounded like mess and chaos differently, because it's a result of a decision rather than an accident.
You know, do you improvise a lot, though, at all?
Well, I do. I try and build as much in as I can, whilst at the same time hanging on to the story. But the problem with it is, like, these days, I'll do a month in Edinburgh every year in August, then I'll do 2 months in London, I'll do 3 months on the road. And by about this third month, most of the possibilities that improvisation can throw up have happened.
And they're integrated.
They start to become, like, codified. Like, you have to kind of force them to happen, you know, a bit like Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a sort of a shelf life for a show. And actually, at the moment, I'm obliged, due to avarice, to tour the shows for longer than they're still sort of alive, you know.
But so you're willing to let an hour's worth of material die with the end of a show?
Yeah. I mean, every time I draw a line under it, and I do so with great relief. This year, I finished this tour in April, I've been doing that show since August, on and off. I finished it within 3 days. I've forgotten it. And then, you know, I was being offered gigs for this month. Can you do the Belfast Fest or whatever? And I have to say, I haven't got an act at the moment. I'll have one by the end of August.
But because moment, you don't want people who have seen you to go, well, that's old bit.
Yeah, but also, I can't keep it all in my head. I don't know what's happened.
But you're not bored with it.
Well, I am sort of bored with it as yeah. well. Yeah, I can't, like, there's only so many times, you know, it does reach a point where it's worked through, you know, and it sort of peaks. And then you try and have to maintain it. And part of my reaction against that is, one of the grindingly difficult things about Jerry Springer the Opera was I'd never worked in commercial theatre. I'd done fringe comedy and little weird fringy performance arty things. So, you know, this was at a national theatre for 4 months in its finished incarnation. Then we had to find a way of maintaining this thing for years in the West End and trying to get it out on tour.
Why was that your responsibility?
Because I was the director and there was no money to bring anyone else in because it was always running at a loss because of various legal issues. And so you had to recast it, but try and hold on to the same show. And you were trying to trick 50 people into, and there was lots. We built lots of improvisation into that show. But a music theatre performer's brain is such that they're looking for certainties, you know, night sure. after night. And in fact, big all them big Broadway shows and the West End ones, when they tour, directors get given a grid of moves, you know, of like square. It's literally like a chessboard of exactly what will happen every night, and I never had a grid, and no one could understand, like, how had you done it, you know? And I think killing the stand-up after 6 months each show is partly, again, of I never want to be in that position again where something's happening.
Where people know. Are like, why don't you use a grid?
Yeah, why don't you use a grid for you, you know?
It'd be easier if you use a grid.
Yeah, a grid of, like, moves.
Here are your jokes. Here are the boxes.
Yeah.
When you did the opera, it was a fringe thing. It was like a cult thing.
Yeah.
And then it got elevated.
And
you couldn't deny the financial, I mean, it was a good opportunity.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you couldn't deny it, yeah.
Did you resent it, though?
Well, but in the end I did, because it was sort of...
They sucked the love out of it?
Well, it did. I mean, it becomes one of those things where...
Business.
It becomes a business, yeah. And in the end, it was sort of... It was effectively closed down by the Christian right, who took against it and kind of made it very difficult to tour.
How did they get a legal case against you? I mean,
well,
I...
because until last year, there was a... Blasphemy was a statute on British law.
Until last year.
Yeah, until about 18 months ago.
So you're a guy that obviously has, after watching your material, your own issues with dogma and religion.
Yeah.
And you were actually in a medieval scenario something that you helped create.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing.
What happened?
Well, the plot of Jerry Springer the Opera was, the first half was like an episode of the Jerry Springer Show with these strange, like, where he'd interview all these guests and whatever. Then he gets shot by a Ku Klux Klan bloke at the end of the first half. And then in the second half, he wakes up in hell, where he replays the whole thing again. But all the guests that from the first half come back as these religious figures, and he's basically asked to mediate between Adam and Eve or whatever, you know, and God and Jesus and
that's
whatever.
That's pretty genius.
And if he doesn't solve it, if he doesn't manage to make the devil friends with God again, then he's cast... go to hell.
Now, how much of that was your creation?
Well, it's me and the composer. We were looking for we wanted to say something about everyone's kind of culpability in
the success of Jerry Springer. Sorts of,
and also about the fact that everyone sneers at, you know, for want of a better word, trailer trash, right? But the kind of emotional problems that are laughed at on a Jerry Springer show are the same as the great plot lines of heavy literature, you know,
and opera.
And opera, their incest, their family relationships that are broken down, whose child is that, all those kind of things.
Uh-huh.
So actually there's a dignity in them as well, if you
right.
know them right.
Sure.
But anyway, the Christians got hold of the Christians on the far right.
Once it was at the National Theatre, though, this
yeah,
was
it was
after.
Fine, it was there. The National Theatre was fine, right?
Yeah.
When it got into the West End, like, they sort of found out about it, and
someone told them, and they unleashed their armies on you.
Yeah, they did. They got 65,000 people
who'd never seen it.
Who'd never seen it to complain about a proposed TV transmission of it, and because the blasphemy law was still on the statute books, they were able to, as was another law which was pending, which mm-hmm. was eventually scrapped. They were able to at least threaten to use the blasphemy law, which was set up.
Now,
it was set up under Henry VIII.
If you get prosecuted, are you burned?
Well, you know, the last time it was used was 1960 something against a magazine called Gay Times, which had a homoerotic poem about Jesus on the cross, which actually weirdly has a relationship with a Dark Ages religious poem called The Dream of the Rood, which is a very self-consciously homoerotic depiction of the cross that Jesus was crucified on. So it kind of, anyway, blah blah blah.
There's a lot of that homoerotic literature in the Bible, in the Old Testament. Song of Solomon is a little.
Yeah. Anyway, they. I don't know what would have happened. Mm-hmm. Is the answer clearly in now? You know, you're not going to send you to prison for it. So it created a difficult thing. In the end, the case was thrown out of court, but they were able to give venues and shops, venues that might have taken the show or shops that might have stopped the DVD of it, the impression that it was actionable. So it kind of finished it off.
Or that they would not shop there.
Yeah, they would not shop there. Yeah,
that happens in the States.
Yeah, and a lot of the big places dropped it, and then a lot of the venues dropped it as well. So, it, you know, it, and so one of the reasons for going beyond the National Theatre with it was that with these shows, if you have one that was as well received as ours is, normally you get to do a franchise of it in every capital city around the world with your grid, with whoever the local star is playing. The French bloke who's a bit like Jerry Springer would play Jerry Springer in Paris. And, you know, Harvey Keitel was supposed to do it in New York. He did it for two nights, like a workshop of it, you know. And obviously that is an income for life, you know. But actually what happened was it wasn't really, you just couldn't, they just sort of finished it off really by complaining about it. And, you know, people had to go into hiding because the police told them there were threats against them and stuff like that.
Actors?
The producers and the BBC people that said they'd put it on telly.
Yeah, we have these religious wackos in the States as well. So it killed the chances for the show.
It did, really, yeah. And but you know what, it was also, but actually when I look back on it now, the bizarre thing is, I sort of don't really mind, because I think it saved me from having to live my life in the world of commercial theatre. And I think it threw me back on the rocks and meant that I had to come up with something else.
This is the second time you're on the rocks. The first time it was self-exile.
Yeah. And, you know, it meant I had to. I've just written a book about doing stand-up, and one of the points that I make is when I went back to stand-up, in 2004, it's not like when that little film about Seinfeld, when he goes, I wonder what it would be like to go and be a comedian again, you know, and goes around and doesn't need to because he's got a house in the Hollywood Hills and Seinfeld's on rotation forever.
Sure. Yeah, you're at the end of your rope.
I was at the end of my rope. I was 36. Nothing I'd done had worked out. And, you know, I was getting to that age where it's very difficult to start anything.
Broke?
Well, I wasn't broke, but there was nothing coming in, you know, and this show that had worked on for 5 years, we hadn't got a royalty for the last couple of years because of all the legal stuff, and it wasn't going to go anywhere, you know, and it couldn't be put on anywhere, and I was not, you know, match fit to do stand up again, and I didn't really know what I was going to do, you know, but I also suddenly I realised when I quit stand up, I was thinking, oh, I can't get this to work. Why weren't these people that want to be entertained listen to me? And it seemed so inflexible, stand-up. I thought, you have to go and do this. You have to open with 5 minutes of strong gags. You've got to do something that works on a Friday night in Liverpool. When I went back to it, I thought, you know what? Compared to trying to organise 50 people in a piece of music theatre, it's easy. You can do whatever you want.
Right, anything you want.
You can do anything you want. Yeah. Right? You can tell a 20-minute story. You can not say anything for half an hour. You can turn your back on them. You
say things over and over.
You can say the same thing over and over. You can leave the stage and do it from the back of the room.
Yeah.
And you don't even have to clear it with anyone because it's just you.
Yeah.
You can write something at 12 o'clock after a long lie-in at midday.
Yeah.
And you can be doing it on stage 8 hours later. And it suddenly seemed, more than all these other things that I dallied around in, it seemed like the absolute greatest form of performance.
So you were sort of born again stand-up.
Yeah, I was born again stand-up because of this other stuff. And also, going to a pub on a Wednesday night and getting a door split of 50 quid was 50 quid a night more than I was making from a thing playing to 500 people in a theatre.
And you can walk away from it. And feel happy with yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if it goes well. But even if it doesn't, I had a similar realization where it's sort of like, I'm doing exactly what I want to do and I can do whatever the fuck I want. Mm. Who the hell gets to say that? Mm. You know, granted, maybe we don't make as much money as you want, but you really can do whatever the hell you want.
You can really do whatever you want. And like, you know, I'm sure you get this in American festivals as well, but in Edinburgh, someone will put on a night and they'll go, hey, we're having a special night of comedy and it's called Outrageous Night. And you can say whatever you want tonight. And I go, well, can't you just do that anyway? Like, have you got some other set that you hold back that's like the thing you actually want to do? Because you're not being stopped.
You have the not funny set. That's what it is usually.
The idea of like, you know, where are these people that aren't?
Yeah.
Saying, well, there's nothing else in it for us.
I imagine when I watch you and I see stuff in myself, which is the only way I can identify with anything, is that there is you are defying the audience.
Yeah, up to a point.
Over a point to some degree. Yeah. Well. And that's your gamble. And I understand it as a comic that like you're going to push them until they might break, and then your card, your reveal has got to be pretty fucking good.
Yeah. Well, it isn't. I mean, I do like that. I mean, that is the weird thing in the last few years of, I mean, I'm really happy now that I do get to play to rooms where the majority of the people have come by choice to see me.
Yeah.
But I also like the fact that there'll be an element where it's not going to work for them, and you have to persuade them, right? And it becomes increasingly hard to contrive as more people know I am and more people that like me come to see me. You know, so you'd be in like Nottingham or somewhere, and 60% of the people have come to see you. The other 40% have come to see some comedy.
Just comedy.
And half of that 40% don't like you.
Yeah. Right?
And on the, you know, on the last tour, I had a whole bit about this kind of theatre, comedy of cruelty, about how there's this kind of thing where everyone can make fun of the handicapped and the blind now, and is that right, you know? And people that are into that kind of thing would be really irritated that I was taking the piss out of it. And then you'd have to kind of win them round. But then when I, and so every night on that tour, I'd have a battle against 20% of the room at least.
Yeah.
There's a bit they wouldn't like, and I get around. But then when I did, at the end of a tour, I did the National Theatre in London, and I played to an absolute textbook audience of London Guardian reading middle class liberals. And as soon as I started on this bit, everyone got it immediately and applauded and went, well done. How refreshing to hear someone say that. And there was not a single pocket of dissent in the room. So consequently,
how did that feel?
Well, it was not much fun, you know, because it just sort of went like smooth, and there was there was nothing at stake,
right?
You know? So I sort of like,
and you resented them for liking you, didn't
sort
you?
Sort of, yeah. And I missed. I was thinking, oh, what a shame there aren't some like skinheads in, like,
yeah,
you know. But on the other hand, I really hate wasting people's time, you know, because I've got a 3-year-old boy now, and like for me and my wife to go out, you know, it's a military operation. We need to get babysitters, and I feel really bad for like people that have come in good faith to see some comedy, and have got a babysitter if they're middle aged and got kids and have gone out and then get me and it wasn't what they wanted. And that's one of the reasons when you saw me in Edinburgh and I was doing that tent, you know, I shouldn't have been in that venue in that tent, because that was like where people went for a night out. You
yeah,
know?
But let me ask you something in relation to that, because you know, you bring up your child, you bring up, you know, where you've been as a person, and that, do you not see? I have to assume that even watching some of the TV vehicle, your most recent TV show, you know, that you like sticking it to them a little bit, as I do too, challenging people.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, but you have a big heart about it, so you actually are empathetic with people that are not going to understand you. And well. But do you find that there was a time where you used to say, like, you don't understand me, go fuck yourself?
Absolutely, and I'm really embarrassed about it, you know. And when in my 20s, well, you know, longer than that. And as recent, you know, until sort of when I quit, I'd get a sort of stupid pleasure in the fact that half the room weren't getting it. You know, I'd be pleased, and I'd be thinking, ah, you squares, you know. And now I just think.
Did you walk rooms? Were you the person that was like, go ahead, leave? Leave.
Yeah, you know, that's the kind of thing. Yeah, or you'd like really, you'd enjoy putting them down if they started on you. Whereas now I try to absorb heckles like a soft target. You know, like last
night, engage in conversation, perhaps,
and like go look. Last night in Bridport, I was in Bridport, and a guy was hating it. You know, and I was.
What did he say?
He was going, boring. You know, and then he was going, get on with it, get on with it.
Oh no!
And I went, look, this is it. I said, this is how I speak. It goes at this pace. There's nothing I can do about it. This is my act. And he was going, get on with it. And I went, what you want? You want more of what you don't like? You know, but I never picked on him. I tried to like keep it soft, you know,
right?
Because I don't feel it's their fault. And having made the television program, and sat and edited 3 hours of myself with the editors on this street, actually further up the street, for 4 weeks, I can understand how infuriating it would be to watch me if you didn't like me, because there's nothing to get hold of. The bloke was going, there's no jokes, you know. I thought, yeah, he's right, there aren't. And he's come out in this little town in Dorset for a night out, and he's stuck in this thing. He hates it, and all the people around him are really laughing. It must be infuriating.
Because in order to fight the fact that he's stupid, not necessarily stupid, but doesn't understand, like, it's infuriating on two levels. I don't understand why they're laughing at him, and why am I not laughing with these everybody else?
Yeah.
You know, it's very lonely. It's a lonely, angry place, Stuart.
Yeah. But you're absolutely right. I did go through that thing when I was young of like, I think, they didn't like it, yeah. And now I try to, when I put quotes on a poster, I put three quotes on a poster, and one of them will always be, I've got many quotes from many papers that say things. I'll put on the worst comedian in Britain, as funny as bubonic plague, the Sun. Mm-hmm. I'll put that on a poster. I put, his whole tone is one of smug, patronising contempt, the Birmingham Mercury. I put that on so that people, it's like a warning. It's like, look, you might not like this. So if you want an absolute dead cert fun night out, don't come.
But yeah,
I've done my best to stop them coming.
But you are like a real stand-up comic. Like, and I've always felt that you know, there's a difference between a comedian and a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
That when I watch you, you know, I don't think alternative. I don't think anything. I just think, you know, great comedian. Like, you know, Bob Newhart or anybody that has, you know, a tone that owns their own space up there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be an actor or, you know, I'm not in this as a means to an end.
Right, this is what we do.
Yeah, because a lot of the comics I like, I love these guys that can write these brilliant one-liners. And even someone who was like off beam or had a weird style like Mitch Hedberg, in the core of that, there was loads of good jokes, right? But I also really like people where it's all about who they are and where they're coming from. And you couldn't take that line and give it to someone else.
Couldn't take anything
from it. And you couldn't take that story and give it to someone else. You know, like, and that's one of the things I thought was great about Paul Provenza's film, The Aristocrats, where Paul Provenza and Penn Jillette's film is great. Let's see 100 people do the same joke, and then we learn what is the essence of them and their delivery and their style and who they are. And like George Carlin does that joke with a world weariness, as if he's been crushed by the responsibility of telling it, which is sort of how he imparts truths to us in his act. Whereas there's other people in it that do it like, as if it's really great fun, and you know. And I kind of think it's quite hard to plagiarize me because the things are too long. And they're about style as well as the words, you know.
Yeah, it would be impossible because so much of it is about rhythm.
Yeah.
And so much of it is about timing.
Yeah.
And so much of it, it would be impossible.
And, you know, and that also makes me think that maybe that the sort of artistic endpoint of stand-up is it's really great. People can write all these jokes. But really, a joke can be written down and retold. And maybe we should be thinking like in sort of three dimensions about what we do. It's not just about words. It's about sound, how they're delivered, rhythm, and who are you as well, and who's saying this joke, and what point of view is informing it.
That's right. That is the art. That's where it comes into.
And that's why all these discussions about taste are sort of spurious, because a bad taste joke or a supposedly bad taste joke doesn't exist in isolation from who's told it. And Chris Rock was very good on this. He said, he says it's fine if you're applying pressure upwards, and where is up depends on where you are. If you're a successful white guy in a smart suit that looks like it costs a lot of money, I would say your targets are limited because you're the man.
Yeah.
You know, you're you've got to think, most of the pressure you apply is downward.
Right.
You know, I think it does make a difference.
But in talking about stand-up as art, and also by pointing out jokes, that's almost demeaning to that model.
Yeah.
That by saying that, like, you know, that joke, you know, as this detached floating thing.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. It's demeaning to being a real stand-up. When people, you know, they say that we're just joke tellers.
Yeah, yeah.
They're demeaning us in a way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of money is spent in publicly funded theatre workshops where, you know, highly educated theatre practitioners sit around working out how to engage directly with ordinary people in an audience, how to break the fourth wall, how to take theatre into unusual spaces. And all those things are things that the worst hack comic does every night. He has to walk into a room and recalibrate everything around the space, who's there, what time of night it is. He has to make in-the-moment choices that people in theatre win like awards for doing. If they do it the slightest bit, people go, it was amazing, he turned slightly to the left instead of walking straight forward because something had happened in the room.
Yeah, it was a choice, improvisational choice in the moment.
Yeah.
What a genius.
What a genius.
And we live that.
A comic is making improvisation choice from the moment they enter the room.
Yeah.
They know, they go, you can't do, that's not going to work here. They won't be able to see me there. The bar's open. The last place you did it was closed. It's like every
It's courageous.
Every single thing is different. Yeah.
You know. Talk about that, about courage.
Right.
Well, you know, in that, you know, how people misuse that word.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
But I guess there's just different levels of
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I like that, the idea of art, you know, in that way, because I don't always wrap my head around it. And I know that it's not so much that we have a higher purpose, but, you know, what we do has got to be defined by the same standards as any other art.
Yeah.
And certain people take it to that point, certain yeah. people don't. So now that you've established this freedom, you know, your ability to talk about religion, you know, political correctness. There's a couple bits. I want to tell this to people because I had not watched you, and people in America don't know who you are. But if you look up Stuart Lee on YouTube, there's plenty of stuff there. You have a novel out. You have a book out.
Yeah.
There are several DVDs out. But the stuff that, like, you actually, when I watched, there were two bits, the Weight Watchers bit you know, dealing with the Muslim issue.
Yeah.
And the political correctness that, you know, if you waited out, even the E.T. bit about ladies' dies,
yeah.
death, is that in the time that you take to humanize the people that you're talking about, mm. and then either use them to skewer what you're talking about, you still respect the people that you are creating up
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Even if they're ridiculous.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of heart in that. And that's what makes it different, that even if you're saying something that's going to, you know, make people feel stupid, or the point you're making is to call someone stupid, the amount of heart you invest in characterizing it, is what makes a good comedy.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, I'd not thought of it like that, but I do suppose it's, again, it's, I'm trying to do a bit about the new government. Right? We've got a new conservative government here. We haven't had one for 17 years, you know, and they tend to be on the right. They tend to be from very privileged backgrounds. And when I started stand-up in the 80s, every comedian and every audience hated the conservatives. That was basically what the comedy circuit was, just loads of people hating the conservatives. And it wouldn't be like a bill you get now. So I was on a bill in Aspen where one woman, her shtick was that she was a black Republican. Another guy's was that he was a white liberal.
Yeah.
You wouldn't get that in the 80s. Everyone was left of center and hated the government, right? And when the Tories came back,
you know, black Republican's a gimmick.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, okay. I know it's a gimmick. Yeah, but even so, you wouldn't.
Okay.
You know, you wouldn't have got someone. So when the Tories got back in, I sort of thought, I wonder what it'd be like now to do that, like, really straight down the line, hating the Tories stuff we used to do in the 80s. It doesn't wash now because society's so much more diverse, you know.
And confused.
And I thought, okay, how do you undermine them? Well, what you have to do is you have to be sympathetic to them, as if their privilege and the fact that they've moved through society without ever meeting any ordinary people, and that they're cowed by a notion of duty towards having to support old financial institutions, is actually a terrible tragedy for them.
It's a burden.
The burden. Yeah, make them sympathetic, and actually they become ridiculous.
But that's a genius thing.
To fight them and say they're scum is sort of, you've lost it already.
Yeah.
And it's a bit, and you know, that's what I would have done 10 years ago. It's a bit like dealing with hecklers, you know. It's sort of funny to sympathize with their inability to enjoy the show.
That's right, to humanize them. Yeah. Right.
And to apologize.
It must be very difficult for you.
Yeah.
You know, it's so sad.
You know, I do apologize that this is what I do, and it's not possible for me to change it.
Yeah.
But
that's really you know, more in line with your style.
Yeah.
That I think that there was a time when you were younger where your style was your style, and your anger about it not being received was that.
Yeah.
And now you because of your confidence and the humility that you acquire just from living, you start to be able to empathize.
Yeah. Well, you do start to be able to empathize. Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, it's, but I also think giving up and then starting again and realizing how grateful you are to be able to be a comic was really important. The other thing is, actually, in the 90s, this phrase got bandied around here by one particular journalist, Janet Street Porter: comedy is the new rock and roll. And what had happened basically was there was a couple of stand-ups in the early 90s who were good-looking enough to be photographed for for magazines.
In general?
Yeah, general, for fiction in general. And looked like they could have been in an indie rock band, you know.
And you were one of them?
No, but I was the second wave of that. You know? And like, you know, I was part of, there was a whole bunch of us that, you know, we would have been in a feature about these new comics in a magazine.
I was one of those in the States, yeah.
You know what I mean? And you'd be photographed in the way that someone would in a band would normally.
Yeah, kind of like with the stance.
Yeah.
With
a cigarette or something.
Yeah, I think there was one in New York Magazine with me, Louis C.K., Sarah Silverman, and David Tell.
That's exactly the sort of thing I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know where I'm from. Anyway.
They give you an outfit to wear.
Yeah. And anyway, I was from that generation. And then by the time when I gave up, I was 31 or something, 32. And it was sort of like, I was getting these reviews going, oh, he used to look like Morrissey and now he's a bit puffy around the face and it doesn't really wash and his quiff's wilted and he's still dressed like an indie rock student from 1989. In the 4 years I had off, I put on about 2 stone, I don't know what that is in pounds, a lot, and I went grey. And when I came back, I was allowed to be miserable and clever. Whereas in your 20s, when you're thin and can get away with a pair of leather trousers, it looks like an affectation. You know what I mean? I actually think some people in all areas of the arts and in life, they grow into the shape that suits who they are. And
hopefully.
And they leave it. You know, it happens to, like, you know, it doesn't work anymore what you're saying because you don't look right for it, or suddenly what you were saying that never worked. Works because you're heavier and older and grayer. And I think with me,
look what life has done to him.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We like him now.
You know, he's entitled to look. Frank Skinner said to me, "Your act will never work." He said to me in his 20s because you don't look. You know, bedraggled. You look too healthy and young to feel like that. And it was like an affectation. You know, it was like an affectation of a cynical affected look at the world.
But also we're just dressing the way we want to dress. I mean, like I look at, even I imagine that if you look at yourself when you were younger, you're probably saying like, that's a ridiculous jacket.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was just at the time you thought it was a good decision.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a couple of specific comedy questions?
Yeah.
In watching the TV vehicle that I saw, there's a sketch piece about a fictional comic called Dill Spinks.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I know the level of which Hicks is revered here. You know, I knew Bill a bit back in the day. I certainly know about him and his material. Now, that was clearly based on him.
Yeah, partly. I can, but go on.
But, you know, my first reaction was like, he's taking the piss out of Bill and Bill legacy.
No, but
then I started to realize that, you know, if I'm not misunderstanding it, what you're taking the piss out of is the myth of Bill.
Yeah, and the perception of someone, like, when they die, they can be made to support this weight of mythologizing. And I think it's something he would have seen through immediately himself.
Right, well, it took me a second, but I did see it.
And he also becomes one of these people that people who don't know anything about stand-up go, oh, I don't really like stand-up. I like Bill Hicks, though. He's fantastic. And you go, well, there's loads of people, you know, just because, like, he's on the sleeve of a Tool album doesn't mean, like, he's the only one. You know, but the other thing, very specifically, that was about was in 1995, Kevin Eldon, who's a comedy actor, and Ben Moore, who's a, like, he's like someone like David Sedaris. He's one of these kind of blokes. Sure. Is that the guy's name?
David Sedaris, yeah.
We went on a road trip in the States for a month, and we went to San Francisco, where we knew Harmon Leon, you know,
and
he was writing Might then, that became McSweeney's after he left, and the guy who's in Flight of the Conchords,
Arch Rocker.
And anyway, we hung around with a lot of comics in San Francisco for about a week, and there was this guy, I forget his name, and he was always talking to Harmon and Arch. He was saying, "I'm doing the Chuckle Hut tonight. You know, do you think I should do my mouse bit?" And they were going, oh, I don't know how it would work there. Then we'd see him the next day, and he'd go, how did the mouse bit go? And he'd go, it went all right, but I'm doing so-and-so tonight. Do you think the mouse bit will work at the Laugh Factory? And they were going, I don't know if it would work there. And, like, we never saw the mouse bit.
Right.
And what we used to do for the rest of the trip, we would improvise in the car various different takes on different American stand-up styles doing the mouse bit.
With the mouse bit you're making up.
Yeah,
yeah. We're
making, and the one we had the most fun with was the Bill Hicks type.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of
angry
guy
mouse
hating
bit.
Mice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And Kevin was particularly good at it. And so years later, that's sort of where that's from is. And the other thing that is also about those cheap documentaries where they've got no footage and they have to keep going back to the same little bit over and over again and, like, vision mixing it differently or whatever. So, you know, it was sort of about that, but it was also kind of, it was really about this, how the dead comedian becomes a sort of a symbol for things that they probably would have found ridiculous in their own life, you know. And like, how many times was he wasn't a comic,
it's a prophet.
He was a preacher, he was a prophet,
a poet.
No, he wasn't. He was a comic, and actually you should be proud to be a comic rather than thinking that it's dignified by comparing yourself to a poet or a preacher. There's bad preachers. There's bad poets.
Sure.
There's some pretty bad prophets.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, most of them.
Most of them, right? So it's
sort of, have to be correct.
Actually, they should be flattered by the comparison to...
Yeah.
You don't justify Bill Hicks by saying he's like something else.
Right.
You say, actually, he's the top of the game of being stand-up.
Yeah.
You know, he's not... Yeah, he's not. And Simon Munnery's got a really funny line. You must see Simon. You know, he got a review saying Simon Munnery's act is the closest comedy comes to art, right? And then he drew a Venn diagram on a board. Like, it can never be art.
Yeah.
There's a gap, right?
Yeah.
There's a gap between comedy and art. And he said he's decided to give up doing comedy and instead try and be shit art, which is really funny. Like, yeah. A good comedy. Never be out. It's going to be right at the bottom of it. You know,
sure.
It's really funny.
Do you believe that?
No, I don't. I think the worst hacky comic that we would all sneer about behind closed doors is making choices and doing things in the moment that are beyond
theater.
That are beyond most practitioners of other areas of the art who you know, largely play it safe. A rock band is protected by volume
and other guys.
And other guys, yeah. And a theater show is protected by the decorum of the theater.
Sure,
we're exposed.
Acts, yeah.
And we're made to.
We're commandos.
Yeah,
we're art commandos.
We are.
Art assassins.
You're more than a comedian. You're like an assassin.
Yeah,
for a commando.
We're going in. We're undercover of a facade that's hiding our pain and fear. And we're here to do some damage.
Yeah.
This is all good stuff, and I hope people go watch the Stuart Lee stuff. Two things seem to happen to you in the last 5 or so years that must have changed your heart significantly. Because there is definitely a difference between your tone as a young man and your tone now. You had a child, and you also found out who your real father was.
The bit you're talking about is I found that, you know, I looked at the paperwork, and then I was able to...
You were adopted.
I was able, but I haven't found out. But
You were just able to decipher that you were Scottish.
Yeah, I mean, I thought I was, but I don't know now. It was because
it
was Church of Scotland on the thing, you know. Oh. So I wrote a load of stuff about that. But I think maybe it is something that chips away at you, the back of your mind. I think an interesting thing about being adopted in the 60s in Britain was there was a degree of social engineering in it. And you know, if you were adopted in the 60s in Britain,
yeah,
and there weren't many adoptions after April 68 because the abortion law was... loosened up, so there's a kind of glut of people my age who couldn't be gotten rid of, and I'm allowed to make that joke.
Uh-huh.
You can't be offended by that because I'm affected by it. It was a degree of social engineering where you were placed at the exact centre of society because the charities or whatever that were doing it, they didn't want to make you like poor, and they didn't want to make you a spoiled rich kid. So you were placed at the exact centre of society, and I sort of think there's an anonymity about it. Like I can't do what a lot of comics do, where they go, "Oh, I've got an Irish background, therefore I'm like this, and I'm not working class, and I'm not like privileged. I'm statistically from the exact centre of society, and I don't know what my racial or ancestral heritage is." And I like the neutrality of it. And when I first came to London in '89 to do stand up, one of the things that comics coming to London do is they make an act that's about where they're from in Britain. If you're from Liverpool, you know, you could talk like that and talk about stealing cars.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were from Newcastle, you talk about how no one wears a shirt and it's really cold. And there were all sorts of different things. And I fought off the Midlands accent that I had and tried to become like nothing. And I think that's partly to do with being adopted and partly to do with the social experiment of knowing that you are exact statistical norm.
Yeah.
You know, and trying to like look at things from that.
Yeah.
And to not fall back on being informed by anything.
Yeah, know? Yeah, that blank so, slate, tabula
yeah, blank
rasa.
Slate. Yeah, yeah,
and that worked for you.
I think so. Yeah, and I mean, it's sort of what's weird now. My wife's just pointed this out. Is that some of the stuff that I do has started to? I have to be a bit more careful with it because if I'm complaining about a particular thing, I used to be just a nobody complaining about it. But now I'm a guy who's had a TV series, and the perception of you is, are you ungrateful? Are you jealous? What are you? You know what I mean?
Temperate with your humility.
With the humility, yeah. So it's weird. That's a weird thing. You sort of finally there's something that is attached to you, which is that he's off the telly, you know. And though it does change
you're up. You're elevated now.
Yeah, You're elevated, which
and
means
your success.
Yeah, which means
you don't have the same freedom.
You don't
to be
have the
pissed
same
off.
Freedom to be pissed off. Yeah, because you know
you're one of those guys Chris Rock was talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean,
does it bother you?
Oh, it does a bit. Yeah. So I mean, yeah, you just have to find a way around it. You have to make yourself seem arguably more unreasonable and absurd, I think, and they kind of accept it. And weirdly, that problem is solved when you have a child, because I couldn't, having had a kid, I couldn't carry on with the same degree of cynicism about the world, because you have to hope on some level that it will improve. Well, you know, because you're made to be a stakeholder in it.
But yeah, but also, isn't there, like, because there are comics now, there's a popular trend to go the other way with children.
Oh yeah, and hate it and moan about it.
To moan about it, and also to continue to be bleak.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it seems to me that the real humanity of having a kid is that somehow or another you are forced, as a selfish person, certainly as a comic, to be selfless and also, you know, to take that final step of maturity in taking that responsibility and also feeling your heart open to that experience.
Yeah.
Whereas opposed to some people, it's like, yeah, what a fucking chore.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't recommend that any comics listening with writer's block, you know, have a child as an attempt to solve it. But right. I do think that it's, you know, in as much as you don't have the time to write and whatever, it does mean that I'm not going to go on and do like an hour about changing nappies and
you'll figure out a way to approach it.
It does, like, it does change the way you look at things.
Well, I mean, it seems to coincide with this empathy that you have now for people that don't understand you or resent you. Well, I got to tell you, Stuart, it's been a pleasure getting to know you. And I appreciate you doing this.
It's really great. Thanks a lot.
That's it. I'd like to thank Stuart Lee and the country of Great Britain for having me. As always, go to WTFpod.com. Get all your WTF Pod needs. Order a t-shirt. Donate some money. You know, buy some of those episodes at WTF Pod Shop, the live ones from comics that we've put up. And also, what else can I tell you? Get on that mailing list. Go to punchlinemagazine.com. Go to standuprecords.com. Go to justcoffee.coop. Or you'll get it all if you get on my mailing list. It'll all be in there. Updates, all kinds of things. Pictures of people. All right. Got to go. Pip, pip. It's been grand. You're all brilliant.